I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:34 p.m. on Monday, April 26, 2021. Present in the room today are Representative Thompson, Representative Carpenter, Representative LeBon, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. We'd like to notice also that Representative Story has joined us today. This afternoon, we will take public testimony on five pieces of legislation and amendments on one if there's time. If it is the will of the committee to pass any, we will sign the paperwork at the end to allow members of the public time to testify. Before we get started, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'd like to address this to Co-Chair Foster. Mr. Chairman, I respectfully request that the operating budget bill, House Bill 69, undergo a more thorough public process of what has changed within the bill since the last committee substitute was adopted. This bill is more complicated than the typical operating bill, and although portions were explained last Friday, the addition of all the federal COVID relief funding is confusing, to say the least. If staff and legislators have a hard time deciphering all the funding that has been moved around and changed, then you can imagine the public has questions as well. In order to ensure a good public process of this bill, I believe it would be in order to provide a more thorough explanation of what's included or changed and go through section by section of, if necessary, of all the changes incorporated. I also question why some capital improvement projects are contained within the bill and why they were not included with the capital budget. I'd also like to know the plan for the dividend, which is not addressed in that bill. And then also, are the supplemental items in this bill? And if not, why? I just wanted to get that explanation out and that statement.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Very extensive question, which might require a very extensive answer. And part of that being just wanting, I guess, some more details and a better understanding of the budget. Let me get back to you on that. Obviously, I need to kind of work with, you know, the folks. I think there is a plan for the timing on when the budget would get to the floor and so forth. And I'm certainly open to it, but I'd like to kind of check in with you know, kind of some folks. We know we're trying to coordinate, like I say, with the floor, and we all know that we're trying to get out of here May 19. I think that's part of the issue that we've had as well. I could tell you that, you know, I haven't liked, I think had it just been the budget itself and not the ARPA funds, the American Rescue Plan money that was involved, this would have been a slam dunk. We would have been done a week ago easily. But with all these funds, it certainly made things more complicated. I think part of the issue is, you know, we've offset some UGF funds with ARPA money, and so it's hard for people to understand exactly what's happened. And so with that, you know, I'm open to it, but if I can maybe get back to you.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and we can get together after this meeting about that, because there is a lot of confusion and a lot of questions coming in from not only staff members that have been around for a long time, but also from the public. They feel like the public process has not been completed yet, and I just am concerned, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Any further comments? Seeing none, and with that, we will first consider House Bill 47, Council for Alaska Native Languages, by Representative Story. The committee heard this bill on Wednesday, April 21st. Representative Story, would you like to make any comments before we begin public testimony?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Merrick, and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, I am Representative Andy Story, representing District 34, which is on Aucoin land, and the indigenous language of this area is Tlingit. Thank you again for hearing the bill. It does two things with which the council, of which I'm honored to be a member of the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council, it offers to shorten it, and so that because the council does do more than work on preservation, it works on restoration and revitalization. So I'd like it to just be the Alaska Native Language Council, and then it expands its membership. Currently, there are 5 voting members. It would move to 7. There are 20 Alaska Native languages. More regions and professional language experts could be on the council. So very simple, There is a new letter of support from the Old Harbor Native Corporation for this bill, and I stand to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, at this time I will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room or online who would like to testify on HB 47? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. Amendments for this bill were due to my office on the 22nd, and we received no amendments. Are there further questions or discussion on HB 47? Seeing none, Mr. Co-Chair, do I have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 47, version 32-LS0314/A from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Seeing none, House Bill 47 is moved from committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Story. We'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Next is House Bill 127, Muni Bond Bank, UA Loan and Bond Limits by Representative Lebon. The committee heard this bill on Wednesday, April 21st. Representative Lebon, do you have any comments before we open public testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would just like to thank Representative Merrick for countering this bill and for the committee hearing the bill, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions should a committee member have one, and thank you for consideration.
Thank you, Representative Lebon. Anything further before we open public testimony? Seeing none, I will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify on House Bill 127? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. Any further discussion? Amendments were due to my office on the 22nd, and we received no amendments. With that, Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 127, version 32-LS0629/A from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Seeing none, House Bill 127 is moved from committee. Thank you, Representative Lebon. Next up is House Bill 28, Exemption for the Registration of Boats by the House Fisheries Committee. We heard this bill on Thursday, April 22nd. This is Representative Tarr's bill, and I believe her staff is here. Would you like any to make any comments before we open public testimony?
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. I would just like to thank the committee for hearing this bill. In short, this exempts active commercial fishing vessels from the duplicate registration requirement that they now have to register both with the Division of Motor Vehicles and also with the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions? Seeing none, I will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room or online that would like to testify on House Bill 28? I see no one in the room. It looks like online we have Susan Doherty with the Southeast Alaska Signers Association in Ketchikan. Saners, sorry. Go ahead, Ms. Doherty. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Yes, my name is Susan Doherty. I reside in Ketchikan. I'm the executive director for Southeast Alaska Saners Association. We are in support of HB 28. We sent written testimony last year on this issue. This legislation fixes the unintended consequences created by the passage of the derelict vessel bill previously passed. The hardship with registering with Department of Motor Vehicles where communities don't have an office, or for permit holders who reside out of state, proved a significant issue for many of my permit holders who I speak for. The intent of the bill that was passed was to ensure proper ownership and contact information was on file in the system should a vessel be abandoned. And so for CFEC permit holders, that information is on file in the state system already, and it is a redundant and unnecessary hardship that has been placed upon the commercial fleet of Alaska. And I would encourage you to pass this piece of legislation, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Doherty. We appreciate hearing from you. Next up in Juneau, I think we'll move to Dillingham. Robert Hinayo, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Robert Hinayo from Dillingham, lifelong Alaska resident and a commercial salmon and herring fisherman in Bristol Bay. I do am speaking in support of HB 28. I believe it corrects a significant oversight. There's plenty of identification on a vessel. A documented vessel has a hull ID number that's registered with the U.S. Coast Guard. As stated previously, we have ADF and G numbers on both sides of our vessel, and a little bit further in Bristol Bay, there's also a requirement to have the vessel name on both sides of the bow of the vessel. So in order to identify a derelict vessel, at least in Bristol Bay, there's plenty of identification numbers that could be backed up with documentation. So please pass the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haino. We appreciate you calling from Dillingham. And next up from Cordova, it looks like Chelsea Heisman, Executive Director, Cordova District Fishermen's United. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Chelsea Heisman, and I am the Executive Director of Cordova District Fishermen United. I'm testifying in support of HB 28. This bill was proposed to correct the issues caused by the passage of SB 92 and unfortunately was not able to pass last session due to the pandemic. The Commercial Fishery and Entry Commission already has a statewide public database of all registered commercial vessel owners, which can be identified by their ADF&G vessel number and searched for by name, fishery, vessel name, home port, etc. online. Most commercial fishermen are also already documented by the U.S. Coast Guard. With the DMV registration requirement, that would be three separate entities that fishermen would need to register with, adding one more layer of regulation before a fisherman can do business. If Alaska is truly open for business, we must pass HB 28. We are in full support of this bill, which solves this issue and allows commercial fishermen to continue with consistent registration processes as they have in the past. Thank you for your time and consideration of our comments.
Thank you, Ms. Heisman. We appreciate your testifying today. I see no one else online or in the room to testify, so with that, I will close public testimony. Is there further discussion on HB 28? Seeing none, we will set this bill aside for a later hearing. Amendments for House Bill 28 will be due to my office by noon on Thursday, April 29th. And thank you, Mr. Brower, for being here with us today.
No, thank you, committee members.
Next up is House Bill 81, Modifying Oil and Gas Net Profit Share Leases by the Department of Natural Resources. The committee heard the presentation on this bill by the Division of Oil and Gas over the course of several days, and we last heard this on Friday morning, April 23rd. So with that, I will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 81? Seeing none, we will move online. I see no one online to testify for HB 81, so with that, I will close public testimony. Any further discussion? Representative Josephson.
Madam Co-Chair, I think this is an important bill, has that potential, and noted that an amendment deadline hadn't been calendared, and I'm toying with the idea of offering an amendment, and I just wanted to make that known.
That's fantastic, because I was just going to say that amendments for House Bill 81 will be due to my office by noon on Thursday, April 29th. Anything further on House Bill 81? Seeing none, we'll take a brief at ease. Next up is House Bill 151, Unemployment Benefits for COVID-19 by the House Labor and Commerce Committee. The committee last heard this bill on April 20th. We have several people online to testify for House Bill 151, so I will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Seeing no one, we'll move online. House Bill 151. In Palmer, we have Susan Deloach, Bright Beginnings Early Learning Center. Ms. Deloach, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
My name is Susan Deloach, and I'm the owner of Bright Beginnings Early Learning Center. And we have four child care centers in Anchorage and Eagle River licensed to care for 455 children ages 6 weeks to 12 years. I'm concerned about the effects that extended unemployment benefits and stimulus checks are having our ability to hire staff. The passing of HB 151 would magnify this problem. I was grateful for the extra benefits when it was necessary for our staff to receive them in 2020 due to lack of work. That was a very difficult year for all of us. For our child care centers to provide care for the parents that are returning to work, it is vital that we have qualified applicants to hire. Even though our business offers competitive wages, health insurance, 401k, paid vacations, and other benefits, we have very few applicants. Many times, applicants don't show up for their scheduled interview. It seems that they're looking to fulfill the requirements for maintaining their unemployment benefits and not actually wanting to work. It has been suggested that we contact the unemployment officials when someone does not show up for their interview or declines a job offer. We cannot be put into the position of policing unemployment fraud. This would be time-consuming and create animosity towards our business. Now it is time to encourage people to go back to work. Enrollment at our child care centers is starting to increase, and it's necessary for us to hire additional staff to care for these children. The extended benefits have made hiring very difficult, and our company is not able to enroll new children because of staff shortages. Last week, it was necessary for us to discontinue care for some of our families, because there's simply not enough staff members to care for the children. The parents of 10 children from our Eagle River Center were informed that we could no longer care for their children. This was devastating for all of us. These are children that we have a relationship with and care very much about. The financial loss to our center, in addition, is $8,000 per month for these 10 children. This week, we're having an emergency meeting to determine how many children we can care for at our other three sites with the staff we have. Sadly, it's necessary to discontinue care for more of our children. This is truly heartbreaking, and it was a horrible decision for us to make, and it puts our parents in a very difficult position. Our current staff members are not getting proper rest. They're often working 10 hours a day with no lunch breaks so that we can meet the proper child-to-adult ratios. This has been going on for the past 6 weeks, so we must take steps to protect our staff from exhaustion. If workers were incentivized to return to work rather than stay home, we would not be in this difficult position. My colleagues and I in the child care industry are struggling financially. Bright Beginnings, our four centers are operating at a total loss of $100,000 every month. We're relying on our payroll protection loan and a grant from the municipality of Anchorage to keep our doors open. Without increased enrollment, we'll be forced to close when these funds run out. I understand the intent of HB 151 is to provide assistance to unemployed people with families. The unintended result would be that families choose to stay home with their children instead of returning to the workforce. The reality is that this will result in child care centers permanently closing. Then, when people are ready to return to work, they won't have access to child care. This will cripple the economy. Please consider targeting funds for the genuinely needy while encouraging people capable of working to seek employment. This will help each sector of our economy recover. Thank you for listening to my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Deloach. We have a question from Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and it's, I guess, not a question, it's more of a statement, but I just wanted to say that I really appreciate the passion that you have for the kids that are in your program, and I appreciate everything that you're doing to try to provide as many daycare positions for working families as possible, and I share your concerns that we really can't afford to lose any more daycare options. I think that we need to find ways to cultivate and grow more daycare and child care facilities in pre-K. So I just want to let you know that I hear you, and that is something that I'm very focused on. So thank you for calling in to testify.
Yes, thank you for your support. That means a huge deal to me.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you for calling in, and I received your email as well, and I do understand the plight of people like you and other small business owners. I guess my question is, prior to the pandemic, how easy or difficult was it for you to hire employees for your business? Was there a noticeable difference with COVID, or was there some difficulties prior to the pandemic?
Well, hiring for childcare is always tricky, but I've been in this industry 40 years as an owner of childcare centers, and I've never seen anything like this. It's drastically more difficult now. I mean, we have never had to discontinue care because of lack of staff ever until last week. And more notices are going out to parents tonight, and it breaks my heart.
Follow-up?
Nope. Thank you for your answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Loesch. We sure appreciate you testifying today. Next up in Anchorage is Jan Carolyn Hardy. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, committee members, for giving me an opportunity to testify to the committee. My name is Jan Carolyn Hardy. I live in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm state vice president of AFSCME Retirees Chapter 52. Dear committee members, I'm a retired State of Alaska employee and a former unemployment insurance adjudicator. During my training, I was taught that for every dollar of UI infused into the community, an additional quarter is generated. That money is spent here in Alaska and circulates in the community, thereby providing more jobs for more people. People want to work. No one likes to be without a job. A job helps to define who we are and to give our lives meaning. Work is a matter of pride. Moreover, when we work, we can save some of our earnings, get the benefit of retirement, qualify for health insurance, and even a 401k. That is not possible when drawing UI. Yes, we pay taxes on earned income, but we also pay taxes on UI. Same for Social Security and any other benefit earned from a lifetime of work. UI claims on February of this year were 208% greater than last year. While things are improving, we have a long way to go in our recovery. On the bright side, augmented UI benefits during the pandemic have increased consumer spending, smoothed consumption, and stabilized aggregate demand and benefited local business owners. The proposed increase in benefits under HB 151 is targeted, temporary, and goes to families who need it. The idea that increased flexibility and benefits are no longer necessary or are bad for business is short-sighted and illogical. Passing HB 151 will result in leveraging $2.4 million in UI benefits paid for by the federal government, providing the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, which oversees UI, with additional flexibility and temporarily increasing a per-dependent benefit of $51 per week for unemployed families with children or who are caring for individuals with disabilities. Since the state of Alaska has the lowest wage replacement rates in the nation and is still down 20,000 jobs from the pre-pandemic employment, we need this bill to sustain our economy and to keep Alaskans from moving to states where they perceive greater opportunity. I know our legislators are aware that Alaskans are not yet out of the pandemic woods. We are making great strides to recovery, but we cannot let our guard down. HB 151 provides for the temporary assistance we need now. I urge you to shepherd this through the committee process, vote in favor, and send HB 151 onto the Senate floor for approval. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Hardy. We appreciate your testimony today. Next in Anchorage, Heather Deloche at Bright Beginnings Early Learning Center. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Hello, my name is Heather Deloche. I am the Corporate Finance and IT Manager for Bright Beginnings Early Learning Center in Anchorage and Eagle River. As a lifelong Alaskan, graduate of UAA School of Business, and mother of two children, I would ask the members of our House of Representatives to vote against the provisions in House Bill 151 that would allow an indiscriminate increase of unemployment benefits until March 2022. The original intent of increased unemployment benefits is to support Alaskans as their places of work were closed due to COVID-19 pandemic. Thankfully, businesses are attempting to reopen and are in desperate need of a workforce to support a recovering economy. Increasing unemployment benefits at this time does not support this effort. Our leadership team has diligently fought to retain and hire teachers to meet the need for childcare in our community. However, the workforce is greatly diminished. As a result, our dedicated teaching staff is becoming overworked as they selflessly tend to the children entrusted to our care. We need more teachers, but the applicants are minimal, and far too many will schedule an interview only to not show up. Hiring has always had its challenges for our industry, but the difficulty in hiring over the last several months is unprecedented. As we are unable to fill vacant positions, we are at the point of needing to turn away families seeking childcare and have been forced to disenroll current families so we can maintain safe ratios. This is currently costing us thousands and will soon cost us tens of thousands of dollars each month in lost income and increased expenses. If the goal of our state's leaders is economic recovery, I would urge financial incentives for employers to increase wages and benefits, funding to the background check unit so we can hire people more quickly instead of having to wait 30 days for a background check, and provide support to the Department of Labor's unemployment insurance staff so they can investigate fraudulent unemployment claims, and so on. These actions would strengthen our economy instead of removing incentives to work and then increasing unemployment insurance taxes. Funding greater unemployment benefits will only increase the number of people using these benefits. When looking at economic incentives, if given the choice to either work or not work while still making the same, if not more, income, the incentive is to not work. Where will our economy be when businesses fail due to lack of workers? There will be few jobs available when the unemployment runs out, and we will have prematurely exhausted the funding to sustain it. A lot of the current unemployment funding is provided by federal resources. Let's send the message that Alaskans want to work for a living. I respectfully urge you to lead Alaska's economic recovery by considering the long-term needs of both employees and employers by voting against House Bill 151. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just a quick question. Do you know if your business already has a mechanism to offer a bonus for a new employee, or is that something that you feel if the state was able to provide for a brief period of time with some of the money from the federal government, would it be beneficial?
We have started offering a hiring bonus. What we can afford is $100, which might not seem like a lot, but it's what we can afford. It's actually beyond what we can afford, but we've started doing that, and it has not made a difference to this point.
Thank you.
Maybe if the hiring bonus was higher, I don't know.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Talosh. We appreciate your testimony today. Next
Thank
up in
you.
Anchorage is Arthur Clark with the Alaska Real Estate Association. Mr. Clark, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Hello, my name is Arthur Clark. I'm the broker owner of Alaska Real Estate Associates. I'm calling today to speak in favor of this bill and supporting it. I understand that there are some thought that this is a disincentive for people to work. I don't know that that's correct. I know that as far as the daycare people go, that there seems to be a problem with people that need daycare, but doing daycare work as well, it makes it difficult for them to do both. That being said, I represent an awful lot of owners of properties that have rental units, and this makes it easier for the folks that are renting from these people to pay their rental fees and pay their utility bills, which in turn makes the housing market a lot more stable. I think that that's an important thing for Alaska as well. There's no easy answers here, but I do speak in favor of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Thanks for calling in today. Next in Anchorage, we have Trevor Storrs, President and CEO of the Alaska Children's Trust. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Trevor Storrs, President and CEO of the Alaska Children's Trust. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today on HB 151. Over the past decade, we've come to understand one of the most effective ways of preventing child abuse and neglect is by addressing the social determinants that foster an environment that promotes trauma and discourages building the skills necessary to manage it. A key social determinant is of families' economic well-being. Alaska is ranked 36th in the nation for child well-being. Specifically related to family economic well-being, we're ranked 34th. Growing up in poverty is a major barrier to healthy child development and increasing the likelihood of poor academic, cognitive, and health outcomes. Poverty has a disproportionate effect on the very young and those children who experience persistent poverty. In 2018, 14% of Alaska's children lived at or below 100% of the U.S. poverty level. 6% of children live in families experiencing extreme poverty, which is 50% of the federal poverty level. In 2018, one quarter of Alaska's children lived in households with a high housing cost burden. The pandemic has only magnified these issues. During COVID, families are struggling to keep dinner on the table and a roof over their heads. Nearly 20% of Alaskan adults living in households with children have little or no confidence in their ability to pay their next rent or mortgage payment on time. Nearly 15% of Alaskan adults living in households with children sometimes or often did not have enough food to eat in the past week. An average of 38% of Alaskan adults live in households with children had difficulty paying for usual household monthly expenses. And over 50% of adults who live in households with children have lost their jobs since March of 2020. HB 151 directly provides economic stability to our most vulnerable families to help ensure these current statistics don't increase, but hopefully decrease. Without HB 151, we will put greater strain on families that put our children at risk. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Storrs. Representative Rasmussen has a question, please.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thanks for calling in, Mr. Storrs. I was just curious if you had been able to listen to the prior testimony from two women who work at a pretty large child care facility in the Anchorage area, and what your thoughts were. I'm personally very concerned about the notices that are being sent out to families right now that they're not able to provide care because they're unable to find personnel. And I would hate to see us lose even more child care facilities when it seems like we have a great need to increase those positions.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Rasmussen. Thank you. Yes, I did hear that testimony, and that's equally alarming. There is no indication that HB 151 is going to cause that issue, and we're talking about some of our most vulnerable families. I, too, can share that I've talked to friends that open businesses, and they, too, are struggling to find folks. And I specifically asked, do you think that it's related to the increase in unemployment, like people are just refusing to come back? And the one gentleman I spoke to most recently indicated no. If we look at the overall funding, I don't think it's that much. And more importantly, we may want to come back as a society and talk about if it truly is more economical to live off of living wage, which unemployment may be providing, maybe we need to be looking and have a discussion about wages in our state.
And a follow-up?
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Storrs, could you tell me roughly how short are we on positions available for child care at the state level at this point? Do you happen to know that, what the need is for additional child care positions?
Through the chair, just for clarity, do you mean how many open positions or need of positions by child care providers?
I'm sorry. I'm having a very difficult time phrasing this, but I'm just trying to understand, and I feel like you would have this information, how many additional child care spots are needed to fulfill the requirement that we have or the need that we have right now at the state level as far as a place for a parent or family to take their child for care during the day while they're working?
I don't know. Through the chair to Representative Rasmussen, I don't have that off the top of my head because of the way you're kind of phrasing the question. So, one, I'm not 100% sure of what is open positions for staff in the state. We could research and see if we could find what's the current status, but it's not a data point that most people are tracking, in the sense of open positions for parents to get in or be able to take their children. I would have to go and get the latest numbers on that because it's ever-changing.
If you could provide the latter, thank you. That would be great. Appreciated.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Storrs. We appreciate you being here today. Next up in Anchorage is Tricia Treasley with Catholic Social Services.
Hello.
Hi. Please state your name and affiliation.
Hello. Hey.
Hello.
Yes. Thank you for having me today. My name is Tricia Treasley, and I am the Vice President of Communications and Development for Catholic Social Services here in Anchorage. And just before I start, I just have some brief testimony, but we support Trevor Storrs and what they're saying over at Alaska Children's Trust. So Catholic Social Services supports this legislation on HB 151 that temporarily expands unemployment insurance benefits for Alaskans with dependents. You know, during this pandemic, Catholic Social Services has seen unprecedented increases in many of our services that work with families and with dependents. Our food pantry went from an average of 100 families per day to 300 families per day during the pandemic. And many of these families are new families seeking food, people that have never, you know, come to the food pantry before looking for food or for food assistance. And in one of our other programs, Homeless Family Services, our housing case managers are finding permanent housing for an average of one family per day. So that's a big uptick from the pre-pandemic. And we've also been providing rental assistance to thousands of families who are on the brink of losing housing. And so it's for these reasons that we ask you to pass HB 151 and support these families with dependents here in Alaska. And thank you for the opportunity today, and thank you for having me.
Thank you, Ms. Teasley. We appreciate your testimony. Next up, also in Anchorage with the Alaska Food Coalition, is Eve Van Domlein. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair American, members of the committee, for this opportunity to provide testimony in support of HB 151 to expand unemployment benefits. My name is Eve Van Domlein, and I represent the Alaska Food Coalition, a statewide coalition of around 120 partner organizations that work together to elevate a unified voice on anti-hunger and root cause issues. As you likely already have heard, food insecurity has risen by an estimated 32% in the past year. And we know that this is tied to many of the compounded hardships that Alaskans have been faced with that have reduced their access to resources over the past year. More than a quarter of our kids now live in households where access to food is not a given. Alaska Food Coalition partners have had to increase their capacity to serve their communities as need for food assistance has grown, some increasing capacity up to 900% from 2019 numbers. I hear from Alaska Food Coalition members frequently about the huge increases in need they are still seeing, many seeing their highest client numbers in the last few months. Even as we see light at the end of the tunnel with COVID-19 vaccines, we're still concerned that economic impacts will take longer to rebound. Unemployment insurance has been such a vital resource for so many of the Alaskans that our coalition members serve, in particular families who have struggled with lost income and lack and the cost of child care options. As we continue to recover, extending these benefits will be critical, not only providing the support, but also the flexibility needed so families can get back on their feet. And additionally, it eases some of the burden of the Anti-Hunger Network and many others who provide basic needs services. As you just heard from Tricia Teasley, those food pantries are still seeing really high need. We urge you to pass HB 151 to extend unemployment insurance to ensure that these families and kids have the support they need during this period of recovery, but also so that frontline organizations can see some relief as well. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. We appreciate what you do. Next up in Juneau is Don Etheridge with the Alaska American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations. Mr. Etheridge, welcome to House Finance. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, this is Don Etheridge with the Alaska AFL-CIO. We're calling in support of HB 151. We have a letter that was sent in to y'all, but we just wanted to add a little extra to this in support of the bill. Right now, we have a whole new group of people that's been waiting to go to work this summer that's not going to get to go to work this year again in our tourism industry and a lot of our seasonal industries that they're not going to be able to go back to work. So they're going to need this support of the unemployment again this year. They lost last year. Now they're going to lose this year again. And there isn't enough work for them all to go to work somewhere else, so they're going to need some help. One of the things that's got to be remembered is that the Department of Labor is doing a very good job of tracking down those that are refusing to go to work and not doing their interviews, and I think they need some more support on it, and those that can support them need to do that. We don't like it when people cheat the system, but we think it's a cheat to those that they can't get jobs to take the support away from them, and their families need the help. But we have the letter in that goes into a lot more detail, so I'll just cut it short with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Etheridge. We appreciate your testimony. Next up in Anchorage is John Fox. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Yes, John Fox. I'm not in favor of the House Bill 151. I own two businesses in Anchorage, and our current problem is we can't find anybody to work. And I'm not alone in that area. There's a lot of business. We all have help wanted signs out, and nobody's applying for a job. I think if you're going to pass this thing, you should do something to wean people off of the unemployment and get them back to working. There's different industries, the fishing industries, but, a lot of tourist business, a lot of that is from people coming up from out of state to work anyways. And I'm just not in favor of it because, like I said, I've been looking for somebody to work for over 9 months, standard help wanted sign out, and I'm not alone. So that's my comment.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Can I ask what line of work that you're hiring for?
Well, I own a cafe, a restaurant. And then I have a construction business.
Great. Thank you for the clarification. We appreciate you testifying today.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. We appreciate it. Okay. Bye-bye. I see no one else online to testify and no one in the room. So with that, I will close public testimony. Next up, we have Dan Robinson, Chief Labor and Research Analyst with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Mr. Robinson, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, yes, this is Dan Robinson. I'm the research chief at the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and I was asked to provide testimony on the specific question of whether there are any Alaska data, any Alaska numbers to support or refute the argument that expanded unemployment insurance benefits may be keeping people from applying for available jobs. We don't have data on openings or applications, but what we do have that I think will be helpful to you is data on the specific hiring that Alaska employers are doing. So when employers file their quarterly contribution reports under the unemployment insurance system, they detail the person who was hired, there's an occupation code, there's an employer code, so we know with quite a bit of detail when workers are hired. And we're actually just putting together some of that data for an article in the June issue of our monthly publication, Alaska Economic Trends. And I'm just going to mention a few industries that I think are especially relevant to your question. And then I have the spreadsheet up, so if people have additional questions about other sectors, they're fairly broad. And this is statewide data. We could look regionally, but that I don't have that at my fingertips. But so the largest number of hires occur in generally lower wage industries, which won't be a surprise. That's where there are just more people who qualify for those jobs and more people that hold those jobs. So, and in the most recent quarter we have available, which is fourth quarter quarter of 2020, there were 7,046 people hired by retail employers. That's interesting because that's almost normal. That's about 100 fewer than the same quarter in 2019. So that tells you that at least that sector, that industry, there's no obvious major disincentive for low-wage workers to come back to work. The numbers are very different for accommodation and food services. That's a category that includes hotels, restaurants, bars, and that's also a very big sector and one that's gotten a lot of attention justifiably for having the biggest number of jobs lost. So there, in fourth quarter of 2020, again, 4,716 people were hired by those employers. That's well down from the normal the year before when it was 6,987. Like some of you, we've heard concern that employers or that workers may not be applying because of the different supplements to unemployment insurance. We're interested to help with that question if we can. So the question that we've asked, and this is informal, it's not a survey or anything, but when I've heard that question or that assertion, my question first, are former employees or anyone else telling you that's why they're not applying, because they can make more money on unemployment insurance? Another question we ask, do you know is it possible that people aren't applying because they're worried about COVID, some special vulnerability they have either themselves or people they're living with? Another question that is interesting and that may have changed the kind of the basic understanding is, are the former applicants, whether they're former employees or potential employees, are they not able to apply because they're homeschooling or taking care of younger kids because childcare options have changed? And then finally, and maybe most interesting to me at least, and to our work here, is it possible that the hassles of being a hospitality worker have increased enough that workers just aren't willing to do that work, some of them at least, at the old wages? So you think about how different it is to be a restaurant server, for example. You're kind of doing some takeout in addition to in-room dining. You might have to hassle with contentiousness of people wearing masks. The tips dynamic changes. And that's, to me, probably the most interesting and important question, or maybe a reminder that labor markets really are markets, and it's not unusual for one side or the other to not like the market changing. And COVID raises some of those questions, but I think the other parts of COVID likely outweigh. And you've heard some of the academic research about there's no clear evidence that it makes a big difference. It's a little bit all over the place, and because openings and applications are a little bit tough to measure, I don't think that's terribly weighty to answering your questions. But this labor market, there are always employers who want to be able to hire better, more, get more applicants. There are always workers who want higher wages. That's a balance, and it's not unusual for it to change. And COVID really kind of raises the possibility of that dynamic changing, and maybe for good. Maybe restaurant workers will demand higher wages. Maybe childcare workers. That's another interesting industry where it's a different set of factors at work with COVID and all the extra hassles that brings. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. We have a question from Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. See if I can get my question straight here. So because of COVID, business had to lay off its employees, and they're now drawing unemployment under that employer. Now that the economy is opening back up, and if that employer contacts a prior employee and offers them the job back, and they say no, does that disqualify them from receiving unemployment benefits?
Yeah, Representative Thompson, through the chair, I heard the hearings, the last couple of hearings where this was raised, and Patsy Westcott addressed that. It's not really clear, except that conceptually unemployment insurance requires recipients to be actively seeking work. There are times that that's waived, and that may be some of what you're discussing with this bill. But it's not meant to be a payment for people not to work. It's meant to be a bridge while work is not available.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I understand what you're saying. It's a bridge because work is not available, but if they were working and enjoying unemployment under that prior employer, and that employer offers them the job back, and they say no, does that disqualify them for receiving unemployment benefits?
It would depend on the reasons they said no, and that's kind of what I was trying to get at with the questions that for research purposes I'm interested in. For managing the system, Patsy Westcott, as the head of the unemployment insurance system, their team would ask, why do you? And if the answer is you're sick with COVID, you're taking care of a child because they can't do in-person schooling, and other possible answers, then they're not available to work, and they're not turning it down in a way that would disqualify them from benefits. But Patsy would be far better to answer those kind of detailed questions.
And we do have Ms. Westcott online. Ms. Westcott, can you help Representative Thompson with this question?
Co-Chair Merrick, this is Patsy Westcott. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay. So, for the record, my name is Patsy Westcott. I'm the Director of the Division of Employment and Training Services. Through the chair, Dan provided some good testimony, and every situation is going to be looked at independently, and it really truly is an independent situation based on that individual's circumstances. So there are mitigating factors that could present themselves to give that individual good cause for refusing work, but certainly the unemployment insurance program is looking at every single refusal of suitable work issue. We are examining the circumstances for each individual situation to determine whether or not that individual had good cause to refuse work. And there does have to be mitigating circumstances. Like, the individual has to have a pre-existing condition that would place them in higher risk to return to the workforce before we would allow or deny benefits, or the employer has not implemented the necessary safety protocols in order for that individual to return to work safely. But just a general fear of contracting COVID is not in and of itself good cause for refusing suitable work, and we take those issues very seriously.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you very much for your answer. I'm just a little bit curious, at being a prior employer, when we would have somebody that we laid off or there was some reason that we ended up having them to go on to unemployment, as an employer, our experience rate on how much unemployment was charged against my company would increase my uninsurance, our rates for unemployment. Is that still type the fact? And would that person that refused to come back to work continue to be counted as a factor in what my unemployment insurance rate would be?
So through the chair, there is an experience rating factor that is part of our tax rate calculation process. What I would say about the state of Alaska is that we're not a direct chargeback state, And so while our rating system does look at massive fluctuations from quarter to quarter in an individual employer's experience, meaning, and by that I mean, you have a lot of wages paid in one quarter, and then the next quarter your wages drop significantly. That can definitely play into the ultimate rate that an employer is assigned from year to year. Slight fluctuations from one quarter to the next will not impact an employer's tax rating system or tax rate to a big degree. Does that answer your question? And if not, I believe that Lennon Weller, who is our economist and UI actuary, is also on the phone and maybe could speak in greater detail to our tax rating system if that does not answer your question.
Mr. Weller?
Good afternoon, everyone. For the record, my name is Lennon Weller, and I'm an economist with the Research and Analysis section of the Department of Labor, and I function as the actuary for the unemployment insurance system. Director Westcott is correct. We have an indirect experience rating system in the state of Alaska referred to as a payroll decline system. If an employer has enough wages reported or quarters of wages reported, then they would, in fact, fall into our experience rating system, where we look at a minimum of 6 quarters, I believe a maximum of 12 quarters, and essentially try to array them from least to greatest in terms of average payroll decline. So it is very indirect. It's almost always the case that on an individual, say, employee basis, it's not going to move you from one tax class to another, but rather larger movements in payroll will generally push you into one tax class or another. And just so that everyone's aware, we have 20 tax rate classes in which an employer could fall into.
Representative Thompson?
Yeah, that'll do. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Representative Wohl, Edgman, and then Rasmussen. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess my first question is for Mr. Robinson. He mentioned the drop in the number of hires in restaurant and certain kind of employees this year, 4,700 fourth quarter. Previous year, 6,900 fourth quarter. So a major drop in the number of hires. What was the category you mentioned before that was held steady at 7,000 in each quarter where there was no drop? If it wasn't restaurant and okay.
Representative Wohl, through the chair, it was retail trade. And the relevance of that, the reason I mentioned that was because they are also relatively low-wage workers and would be most interesting to us as looking to see whether other low-wage workers were not coming back to work because of an increase in the benefit amount.
Thank you. And as you said before, there, I don't know, you comment on retail, but the other workers are tipped employees. And so if a place has a lower number of customers dining in or drinking in or however, their wages are going to be substantially reduced, regardless of what the employer pays them. Whereas in retail, that's much less of a factor. Wouldn't you agree?
Right. Yes, definitely.
When did the federal benefit of $600 a week supplemental end? And was there a change in hiring data at that point or approaching that point, or do you have that data?
Yeah, Representative Wohl, through the chair, we have the data quarterly, and that the $600 expired at the end of the second quarter. So we do have, and I was, there have been, I think we're at $300 now, there have been some different supplements, I think three now. But yes, it's useful to just know we have this data, this hiring data by quarter.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. So do you have enough data to compare the quarter when the, for example, the quarter before the supplement ended to when it ended. Now, it went from $600 to $300. Did you notice a change in the hiring data for either retail or the hospitality industry?
Representative Wohl, through the chair, there were enough other, I have that very same question, there are enough other things happening that if that was a factor, and it very well could have been, it was well washed out by bigger factors, and I'll just give you an example. So accommodation and food services, that same category, so that's restaurants, bars, like I mentioned. So second quarter of 2019, just as we're heading into the summer tourist season, 14,520 people hired. Second quarter 2020, 5,943. So well less than half were hired. That's also when they were getting the $600 supplement. But then third quarter, the number doesn't go up very much. 7,594, also still well below the previous year, same quarter, 11,600. So shorter answer, bigger things were at work that would, we couldn't isolate that, but we couldn't come close to isolating that factor if it was there.
Okay. Thank you. Follow
Representative
up.
Wohl.
Thank you. So it sounds like there's a lot of noise there that you can't really isolate if the end of the $600 down to $300 caused more hires. There were more hires, but there's enough other factors. You can't isolate the cause and effect.
Right.
And I guess this is a benefit question, so maybe for one of the other, I forget her name.
Ms. Westcott.
Thank you, Ms. Westcott. So I've been an employer in the past, similar to Representative Thompson, although I probably was an employer more recently. But I wasn't an employer during COVID, so I can't really speak about COVID. But I can speak, and again, I know everyone's heard my story, and it's anecdotal, and some of the data doesn't support it, but a lot of the reports I'm seeing that were distributed are more about aggregate data, which looks at the whole system, a holistic analysis, whereas individual industries experience different things. My experience quite often was if I had an employee that received benefits and I wanted them to come back, as Representative Thompson explained a scenario, and I'd say, hey, do you want to come back to work? I could use you or whatever. If sometimes they would say, I'll come back for if you pay me cash because I don't want to lose my benefit, whether it's unemployment or Medicaid. Medicaid also requires a major paperwork change if you have an employment change that many people didn't want to go through. Is there, in this current benefit system, I know that if someone wants to work part-time, let's say someone's getting unemployment and someone says, hey, I got 10 hours a week for you or 12 hours a week. My business is picking up slowly. Can you come back for a few hours? What does that do to their benefits in this scenario when they're getting unemployment plus a per-child credit of $75 plus the federal supplement of $300? Is it a sliding scale? Can it be adjusted, or do they just lose it? And that, because you know, again, I haven't been an employer during COVID, but prior to COVID, many times people want to work for cash so they can keep their benefit. And the Department of Labor says, oh, but they're committing fraud if they don't want to accept work. And I know that. I think they know that, but I don't think it's really enforced. And I guess that's my next question. First question is sliding scale.
Ms. Westcott.
So through the chair, Representative Wohl, thank you for those questions. Those are great questions. So number one, what I would say is that wages have to be reported to us. So working under the table for cash is a violation, and so those wages need to be reported to us just as any other wages need to be reported to us. As far as working part-time, I'll try and explain this without getting too down in the nits and grits, but so an individual can work part-time. It is currently deducted at 75 cents to the dollar, meaning that if they, for every dollar they earn, we would deduct 75 cents off of their potential unemployment insurance benefit amount for that particular week. So it's possible that an individual could work for, 10 hours in a week and still be eligible for a partial unemployment insurance benefit into the in addition to the wages that they receive for working 10 hours per week. Does that answer your question, Representative Wolf?
Through the chair, thank you. Yeah, it does. I guess what you're saying is if they work, that gets deducted from their unemployment at a rate of 75%. So,
through the chair, Representative Wool, that's correct.
It's not much of an incentive to work, I guess.
Oh, one other thing that I would add is that there is provision in state statute that the first $50 of earnings in a given week is not deductible from their UI benefit amount. And then after that, it's deducted 75 cents on the dollar.
Okay, thank you. Follow up, please.
Thank you. Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess my next question has to do with enforcement. And your statement about being paid cash has to be recorded and all that. And, there's a world out there where people work for cash and don't report it. And I'm sure you guys know that, maybe not to the extent private employers know it, but it's out there. And as far as people not accepting a job when it's offered, even though, there may be some fraud if they're still collecting unemployment or if they're not actually looking for a job and state that they are, how many cases do you guys sort of pursue in that arena, or are you just too busy getting benefits out mostly?
So through the chair, Representative Wall, at this point, we have detected less than 1% of fraud. With that said, we continue to audit and investigate claims every day. And so, I'm certain that percentage will go up. I mean, these types of episodic programs where, massive amounts of dollars in federal unemployment benefits go out the door creates a ripe environment for fraud. And so we continue to investigate claims every day. We will continue to identify, detect, establish, and collect on fraud. Right now, I would say our fraud rate is very low. But certainly that is something that that we continue to investigate, and actually we are in the process of adding additional positions to our benefit payment control unit for that very purpose. We don't like any dollars to go out the door in fraud, and that's something that we take very seriously. And that's something that, while I know it might be a little arduous for employers to report to us, we certainly do want employers to contact us if they have situations where an employee is refusing to go back to work because potentially unemployment insurance benefits pay them more than what they could get if they go back to work. We're very interested in hearing about those cases.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for indulging me. And I'll be very brief, I think. To go back to Representative Thompson's scenario, where you have an employee who is not working for you and you want to get him back, and you say, hey, I got a job, why don't you come back? And they say, sorry, I'm making pretty good money on unemployment. I don't really want to come back. And Department of Labor says, well, you can report that person for fraud. The problem with that is if you ever want them to come work for you again, and they are a valued employee, and that's why you're asking them to work, and you report them for fraud, they will never work for you again, and they'll tell all their buddies not to work for you again. So you've created a problem where if you have to self-report a valued employee who you do want to work for you, you're in a bit of a pickle if you start reporting all these people for fraud. And I'm sure you guys have thought that one through. But my last question is the supplemental federal $300 a month that's currently coming our way. What is the expiration of that? Do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, those benefits are extended through September 6, 2021.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm going to try not to get too esoteric here, but I'm trying to get a better sense of the bigger picture here. Alaska's lost population over the last few years, and just off the top of my head, I know that some of the population that was lost in 2020, I think, would be part of the workforce that this bill would possibly address, those in the food service industry and those that might be tied to tourism and the seasonality of all these jobs that, as we all know, with the cruise ship in, presence in Alaska, that's going to be greatly diminished. You know, a number of jobs just may not exist that were there before. But so I'm trying to get a sense, I don't know if this is for Mr. Weller or Mr. Robinson, of whether or not that observation would be, you know, considered legitimate. And then the second part would be, you know, the opening up of the economy. That to me seems to be, you'd have to qualify that statement in order to really give it the proper definition, because again, we're a highly seasonal state, and just the fact that we're not going to have the tourism industry that we normally have, and then the sort of the multiplier impacts and the downstream benefits that would lead to jobs for people just aren't going to be there. So the fact that we're down 23,000 jobs now may change as we get into summer and more activity commences. But so could it be ascertained that some of these people who would ordinarily be filling the jobs that we've heard today that are going unfulfilled may have moved out of the state? And then two, even if they're remaining here, I'm sure there are going to be more jobs in comparison to 2020, but in 2021, we're not going to be at full strength or back to quote-unquote normalcy in terms of all those jobs being available. But a bit of a commentary there, but I'd like to hear the department's response to that if I could.
Mr. Weller, would you like to give a shot at that?
Sure, absolutely. For the record, my name is Lennon Weller with the Research and Analysis Section of the Department of Labor. Through the chair, Representative Thompson, the first question regarding migration, in and out migration, net migration, you're correct that we've seen some pretty big net negative migration. Unfortunately, we don't have a really good handle at this point on the composition of those who have vacated the state, say, in the last 12 months or so. So it would be hard to say whether or not that would match the potential labor supply for a lot of these jobs that may or may not be available. So that's certainly something that I think eventually we'll probably have a better handle on, but it's just been too soon, and a lot of those data sets come with enough of a lag that we just don't know at the moment. But certainly, out-migration could arguably be, you know, a factor in certainly reducing labor supply, available supply of individuals looking for jobs, especially considering that the rest of the nation seem to be opening up maybe a little bit faster than us. Seems to be, that economic activity seems to be coming back a little bit quicker in other areas of the country, and so it's likely that we're competing, for that labor pool, so that's certainly a factor. Would you mind repeating the second question?
Representative Edgman.
Thank you. So the second question was about the economy opening up and whether broadly stating, it's true, but there also are other, there's a number of sectors in the economy that aren't going to return back to full force maybe until 2022 or even beyond. at this point, a lot of them tied to the tourism industry.
Sure. So through the chair, and I apologize, Representative Edgeman, demand has been a bit elusive, and certainly I think for Alaska relative to the rest of the nation, obviously looking at tourism, how heavily dependent we are seasonally on those ships in particular, and the demand that drives for leisure and hospitality, for retail trade, for water and air transportation, certainly through April through roughly September, October, that's going to be tough for us to, I think, overcome. I think something, though, important to keep in mind, though, at least with our current unemployed population, is that, you know, the pandemic occurred kind of pre-season, pre-tourism season last year this time. And so, you know, a lot of what we normally would have seen in jobs over the summer just didn't occur. But on the flip side of that, you know, a lot of the individuals that lost their jobs, it was disproportionately those who, you know, were employed throughout the year. And so I have a sense, just looking at as we open up, that the economy should be able to reabsorb a good number of those individuals as we continue to open up, as vaccination rates continue to go up and the virus, you know, continues to get more under control. But you're absolutely right that it's in these later stages of this pandemic, it's going to be, I think, frustrating, and it'll come with fits and starts, and it's going to be a bit messy in terms of reabsorbing these individuals back into the labor force. Does that hopefully answer your question?
Follow up?
It does, and I didn't expect a sort of ironclad response to a picture that seems to be, you know, still emerging, and the data sets out there not gathered. But it just seems to me that, you know, this whole the pandemic as a whole, it's just hard to make blanket statements about anything, right? And that this bill, the way it's structured now, would benefit a number of Alaskans. To what extent, I guess, time would say. And you know, the fact that there may be, you know, we heard earlier from a couple of child care operators and from another testifier that there simply isn't anybody out there stepping forward to work under the, you know, what I gather to be the, you know, sort of pretense that that they're collecting unemployment benefits and just not, you know, incentivized to get out and work. But it's very difficult trying to tease out, okay, what percentage of people is that out there? And, you know, is the control mechanism through the department that weak that there's a number of people just taking advantage of this program in general? And I tend to think that that's not the case. I'm not hearing sort of a more definitive response from the departmental officials on whether this bill provides more good than bad. And, you know, my experience is it does, but can anybody in the department say, yeah, this bill does provide a lot of benefits that wouldn't otherwise be available, and it's necessary?
Ms. Westcott?
So, through the chair, I would like to respond to that. Thank you. Thank you so much for raising that. What I would say about this particular bill is that we forecast that we will have about 10,000, or just under, actually 11,000, new filers between April 1st and September 6th that would potentially benefit from the provision in the bill that waives the waiting week provision. In addition to that, in any given week, we have between 25,000 and 30,000 individuals that file for benefits that have one or more dependents that would benefit from the enhanced dependent allowance.
Representative Edgman.
So, in other words, am I to interpret that as a sort of a vote of confidence for the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the department is neutral on the bill, and I, my role is just to provide the committee with information to make an informed decision regarding either approval or non-approval of the bill.
So I guess through the co-chair, we don't have anybody online that can speak to the bigger question of, well, this bill would actually help Alaskans, therefore it's good. And we have a lot of people who provide technical analysis, but we don't have the division director, we don't have anybody from the commissioner's office online that can answer that, apparently.
Ms. Westcott, did you want to respond to that?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, what I would say is that, again, what I would say is that we forecast that there would be just under 11,000 Alaskans that would benefit from the provision in the bill that provides for a waiting week waiver. And in any given week, we have between 25,000 and 30,000 Alaskans that are claiming benefits that have a dependent that would benefit from the additional enhanced benefits, dependence allowance benefits.
And with that, at our next hearing, we can work with the bill sponsor to bring somebody from the department that might be able to clarify further for you.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Westcott, I'm looking at a document that some wise person put in my folder. It says, provided by the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, March 2021. It's a two-page, really one-page and a little bit document that lists valid cases, replacement ratio, average weekly benefit amount. Are you familiar with that document?
Through the chair, I might be. Are you talking about our wage replacement ratio?
Yeah, it's through the chair, follow up.
Yes, follow up.
It's a table of numbers drawn from 2019.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, it shows we're in last place, and it looks like we're in last place under replacement ratio one. Am I right about that?
Through the chair, that is correct. We are nationwide as far as wage replacement, and let me just explain what wage replacement, what that is. So the wage replacement ratio looks at the state, or it looks at the state average unemployment insurance benefit amount as a percentage of the state's average weekly wage. And through the chair, yes, we are last in the nation as far as wage replacement.
Follow up.
So while I appreciate concerns about, I had to look up the word, although it's in my active vocabulary, I just forgot it, but the word is indolence. That is people who could work harder and try harder. That is people who are, they're getting UI that they could avoid if they really tried. I understand that there's likely instances of that, but I look at this and I say, wait a minute, we are the absolute worst state in the United States at wage replacement ratio. We're just awful at that. The statute 232350 shows the most recent reform to our UI law was in session law 2008. Now I can't, without pulling the session laws, I don't know whether that just tweaked one thing or another. So I don't know the last time we got into the meat of the numbers relative to replacement ratio, but I do know it's been at least 13 years. So we're awful in terms of our generosity, and this bill simply says, let's authorize $2.1 million for a week of non-delay in replacement that the federal government will pay for. Now you could get into the argument about, well, geez, who's paying for all these trillions of dollars? And I hear that, but this is $2.1 million. And then we're increasing from 25 to 74, 24 to 75 per child. I guess my question, it's a big buildup, but my question is, if people are abusing the system nationally, even with these other generous features, we're still among the least generous, are we not?
Ms. Westcott?
So through the chair, well, again, our wage replacement rate is the lowest in the country. That is true. You are correct that if HB 151 were to pass, the provision related to the waiting week waiver is fully 100% federally funded. The provision related to the enhanced dependence allowance would definitely be a cost to the state's trust fund, and I would defer to Lennon Weller to speak specifically about that. But you are correct that we are the lowest in the country as far as wage replacement rates.
Thank you. We'll take one more question from Representative Lebon, and then we have another bill that we must get to today. Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the testimony and the information being shared with the committee. And I guess my question is a macroeconomic question for Alaska. If our goal is to reopen our economy sooner than later, does House Bill 151 help us accomplish that goal?
Ms. Westcott?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, I do, again, the department is neutral on the bill. I think there are provisions in the bill that certainly provide benefits to unemployed workers that are fully 100% federally funded. Again, I will state that the department is very interested in hearing about any situations where an unemployed worker is refusing suitable work because unemployment pays more.
Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess there was an element of unfairness to that question, so I appreciate the response. But I guess I heard earlier that there was speculation that maybe the labor market had changed and maybe employers needed to pay more or offer additional benefits in order to attract labor. And if that were to be the case, then it's more essential than ever to reopen Alaska businesses, fully reopen businesses, because if capacities are held to 50%, be it a daycare center or a restaurant or a similar type business, economically they won't make it at just 50% occupancy. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lebon. And we will have some more folks from the department come and try to give further clarification on some of these questions. But for now, we'll set HB 151 aside and take up our final bill for the day, which is House Bill 41, Shellfish Projects, Hatcheries Fees. The committee heard this bill on Wednesday, April 21st, and amendments were due to my office on Thursday, the 22nd. We have one amendment before the committee from Representative Thompson. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will not introduce amendment number one at this time, but I do have a conceptual amendment in its place.
With that, amendment number one has been removed and withdrawn. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move a conceptual amendment that sections 7 through 10 are effective through June 30th, 2025 only. These sections are the ones that address the ASME portion of the bill.
Thank you. I will object for the purposes of discussion. First, we shall take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Before the ADEs, I had objected for the purpose of discussion. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 41 has a section in it that say that the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute would market aquatic farm products, and that the aquatic farm product industry would not be putting any money into ASME. Mr. Woodrow, when his testimony was up, stated that there would be probably a $100 million industry in a few years. Without a seafood, or without a sunset on this, I would think that the seafood marketing company, when it gets up to a $100 million industry, would want marketing. And I feel like that industry should have some skin in the game, if you will say. They should be paying for something if they are going to be requesting it. So I feel like in 4 years, it needs to be revisited to see if there is a need for the industry to put money into ASME to help with their marketing. I feel like that they should be involved the same as the fishing industry is involved in marketing their products. They put in 0.5% of the ex-vessel that through the processors. The reason I withdrew my original amendment is we looked at the way we were going to do to have them pay in the same as the fisheries, and according to revenue, that would have maybe double taxed that industry, or it would be very difficult, and it was just got to a point where it was like, okay, this wouldn't work. How about if we just put it in that in 4 years, if they are needing marketing, they should be able to pay for it. It needs to be revisited, was the purpose of this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Representative Edgman.
Yes, I just want to thank the former Fisheries Committee Chairman for that astute commentary, and I think he's right. I'll support it.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Nothing, Madam Chair. I'm good. I'm fine with his amendment.
Thank you. Further discussion on the conceptual amendment? Seeing none, I withdraw my objection. Is there further objection? Seeing none, conceptual amendment number one has passed. And this takes us back to the bill itself. Do we have any other questions or comments on this bill before we try to move it out of committee as amended? Seeing none, Mr. Co-Chair, do I have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 41, version 32-LS0291/B from committee. As amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Hearing none, House Bill 41 is moved from committee. And this concludes our agenda for today. Amendments to House Bills 28 and 81 will be due to my office by noon on Thursday, and our next meeting is tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. So with that, at 3:12, we are adjourned.